A large part of the goal of this class is to get you, the listener, to the point that you read and study the Old Testament on your own. The Old Testament is really fun to read and study. However, over the years, I've had a number of people approach me that have had a lot of problems with it and wanted to know what they could read to best understand it. And I am still an advocate of the fact that the best way to understand the Old Testament is to read the Old Testament itself. There are some barriers, however, to reading and understanding the Old Testament. One is its size. It's a big book. And there are, in many cases, no clear flow of events. And for this reason, a lot of times when you study, you need to have a pad of paper out and kind of track things that you're reading about or what's going on. Another thing that causes people problems in the Old Testament is they get stuck in some of the more difficult sections, so they don't ever get to the fun and easy parts. They get stuck in the tabernacle area, or they get stuck on civil law, or they get stuck in the genealogies, and they think the whole Old Testament is like that, and it's just not true. Again, I'd say I wouldn't start by reading a book about the Old Testament. I'd read the Bible itself. It's easy and it's fun to read if you're in the right areas. And by that I mean I'd read the parts that are more straight history. And think a second. You can read a book like Moby Dick and from beginning to end and have a recollection of what the storyline was and who the characters were and what the point of the story was. The Old Testament is not as easy to read because there are genealogies, there's laws, there's lists, there's chronology, there's stuff about the tabernacle and ceremonial law, all weaved in that tends to detract from or distract from the main storyline when you're a beginning reader. What I as a beginning reader would do is I'd read Genesis, and you can read Genesis pretty much straight through without having any problems or going down any detours. I'd read the first 20 chapters of Exodus and then pick up the 24th chapter and 32 to 34 and then 40. When it came to the book of Numbers, I'd read chapters 11 to 25 and then 32. With Deuteronomy, I'd just read about the 32nd chapter, starting in verse 44 to 52, and chapter 34. And I'd read the first 12 chapters of Joshua, the first 12 chapters, 1 to 12, the first verse of chapter 13, and then the last three chapters, chapters 22 to 24. See, with Joshua, for example, that's a good example. You start into Joshua, and it starts out, and it's action-packed, and yay, and you get to the 13th chapter, verse 2, and remember now there's been war after war after war after war, and there's a lot of people that need to have a place to live. So now the next umpteen chapters are Joshua enumerating who's going to live in what city and what tribe is going to get what land piece. Many of the cities, we don't even know where they are. I mean, they've never been discovered. So you sit there, and for chapter after chapter, you just get more bogged down, and finally you quit. You say, geez, chapter Joshua's horrible. And you never get to the three exciting chapters at the end, 22 to 24. Read the book of Judges straight through. It's a lot of fun and easy to read. Read the book of Ruth straight through. I'd read 1 and 2 Samuel straight through and 1 and 2 Kings straight through. When it came to Chronicles, you start reading Chronicles, and it starts out with almost 10 full chapters of genealogies, list of name after name after name. Start in 1 Chronicles chapter 10, you'll have an easier time. If you read the Old Testament like that a few times, then when you get into the part about the tabernacle, about the ceremonial law, about the civil law, it'll make more sense because you'll have some history to tack those things onto. The same with the prophets. I wouldn't get in a hurry to read Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Zephaniah, Zechariah, Malachi. I wouldn't get in a hurry to read those because prophets don't speak in a vacuum. They spoke about the times and events and people that you'll be learning about as you read Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. If you try and read the prophets without an understanding of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, then you don't have an anchor. For example, if in the book of Amos it talks about the walls of Samaria will be cast down because of the sin of Samaria and this and that and the other thing, and you're saying, what's this talking about? What's it referring to? But if you've read Kings and Chronicles, you not only had seen it coming, but you've actually seen it be fulfilled as the Assyrians destroyed Samaria. I would read Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. They are exciting to read, and for the most part, you can read them straight through without getting bogged down too much. And get an Oxford Bible Atlas or some kind of nice Bible Atlas that will allow you to get a geographical orientation, and we'll be talking more about that in the class. Another thing that I think you have to understand the Old Testament is something that we call the idiom of permission. Now, we did some nice work on the idiom of permission when Christian Educational Services produced Introduction to God's Heart. Our class on the Bible as a whole and the overview of the whole Bible. We also have an appendix in Is There Death After Life on the idiom of permission. But it's so important to the understanding of the Old Testament, I need to review it and overview it here at this time. If you'll turn with me to Exodus chapter 9, verse 12. Exodus chapter 9, verse 12. While you're turning there, let me explain. The Hebrew idiom of permission explains why God appears to be so mean and nasty in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, he's love, and he's light, and he's wonderful, and he's helpful, and he gives every good gift. In the Old Testament, you don't do what he says, he kills you off. And if he wants you to do something you don't want to do, he hardens your heart and forces you to do it. Now, Malachi says that the Lord does not change. So either he really is mean and nasty, and he hardens people's hearts, and he kills people off, and he causes plagues on people, and destroys believers when they don't obey him. Or, as Jesus Christ taught, the Lord is love and light. You can't have it both ways, because Malachi does say he doesn't change. So he's either mean and nasty, or he's nice. And the question would be then, if he really is nice, if Jesus Christ was telling the truth, and the New Testament is telling the truth, that he's love and he's light, and there's no darkness in him at all, why is it in the Old Testament he seems to be so mean and nasty? And the answer to that riddle is called the idiom of permission. By the way, you can learn more about the idiom of permission also in E.W. Bollinger's work on figures of speech in the Bible, and also even in the Young's Concordance, the older one, not the newer one is harder to understand, but in the older, I just call it the Common Blue Young's Concordance, in their Hints and Helps to Bible Interpretation, they give some examples of the idiom of permission. I believe the help number is number 70 under section B. But if you look at Exodus chapter 9, verse 12, what's the scenario here? Well, the scenario is the children of Israel are slaves in Egypt, and they want to get out, and there's been some plagues up till now. In fact, there's been five up till Exodus 9, 12, and so Egypt has certainly had a taste of the Lord's disfavor. And you see here that Pharaoh is just about to let the children of Israel go so there won't be a plague, verse 12, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he wouldn't listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said. So then the Lord looked down and he said, aha, I see you've hardened your heart, and you won't let the children of Israel go. Well, I'll smite you with a plague. Ha ha, take that. Now wait a minute. First of all, God does not take away people's free will. I mean, that is one of the gifts of God, that you have free will, and God isn't going to take it away. Furthermore, God isn't going to force you to sin, and then punish you when you sin. That doesn't make any sense either. What are we dealing with here? We're dealing with an idiom whereby an active verb actually is used in a permissive sense, or portrays a permissive occurrence. Remember that in the Old Testament, Jesus Christ had not come yet, and it was Jesus Christ who revealed the snare of the devil. It was Jesus Christ who, according to John 1:18, led out his Father. In the Old Testament, people did not have God's Spirit. They didn't have the Spirit of God on them. So they had no way of dealing with the devil. So for a number of reasons, God hid the existence of the devil. for a number of reasons, God hid the existence of the devil and took upon himself the position of, I am God, I am totally sovereign, if it's good, I do it, if it's bad, I do it. The New Testament, we're going to find, will change that picture. But the change of the picture revolves around the individual believer having spirit and being able to deal with the devil, which is why Jesus Christ revealed his snare. But just for the Old Testament text, you look at Exodus chapter 9, verse 12, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. We would analyze that text as the Lord allowed Pharaoh to harden his heart. Well, gee, the Lord allowed Pharaoh to harden his heart? Why did God allow it? Simple. He couldn't stop it. You want to get drunk? Get dressed up in black? Go stand out in the middle of an interstate on New Year's Eve? You'll die. Somebody might come along and say, well, the Lord didn't like him, so he killed him. That would be the Old Testament. The Lord didn't like him, so he killed him. Where in reality, you did it yourself. Here in Exodus 9:12, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. The Lord allowed Pharaoh's heart to be hardened. Why? Pharaoh didn't want to let the children of Israel go. He wasn't particularly upset that his people had been plagued. He wanted to control the Israelites, and he wanted to control the people, and he wanted to control the money. So he hardened his heart. The devil probably had something to do with that also. I'll show you another one. If you look at Numbers chapter 21, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21, the children of Israel are in the wilderness wandering around. In verse 4, they traveled from Mount Hor along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread. There's no water. We detest this miserable food. Miserable food, by the way, would be manna. Verse 6, then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them, and they bit the people, and many of the Israelites died. And God said, ha ha, that'll teach you to complain about my food that I supply. Complain again and I'll get you with something else. Ha ha, bite them, snakes. Now, wait a minute. These are God's people. He's trying to save their life. He's trying to get them into the promised land. He's not going to send snakes. Who does want the people to die? Who doesn't want the people in the promised land? The devil. The devil. So, but God, in the Old Testament, the devil, the snare of the devil was not revealed. It specifically, the New Testament says, Jesus Christ revealed that. So in the Old Testament, God is portrayed as sovereign. And you've got to understand that. God does not kill believers. God does not harm believers. That's what the devil does. And the devil wasn't revealed in the Old Testament. You'll remember the cry of Elijah when he was living with that widow woman during the 3.5 years of famine, and the widow woman's son died. And he went and laid the child on a bed and cried to the Lord and said, will you bring evil also upon this woman with whom I live by killing her son? Lord, what's going on with you? You cause a famine and there's Israelites dying all over the place, and now this widow woman's son dies. You know, where are you coming from? And there's this horrible cry of the soul to understand, how could things be so good and so bad? And how could God behave this way? Well, God revealed himself as sovereign and in charge of good and bad. By the way, as we go through the records of the Old Testament, we'll see that. If you'll go to Luke chapter 10, now we're in the ministry of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, in Luke chapter 10, verse 1, after this the Lord appointed 72 others and sent them two of two ahead of him to every town and place he was about to go. So he sends out these 70. In verse 17, or 72, verse 17, the 72 return. The 72 returned with joy and said, Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. There's nothing like that in the Old Testament. Moses never said, oh, hey, God, devils submit to me. Elijah never said, oh, wow, devils are subject unto me. Daniel, a great man. Never said, oh, devils are subject to me. Where did these apostles learn about devils? Jesus Christ taught them. Jesus Christ taught them. He replied, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. Overcome the power of the enemy. The devil has power on the earth today. Adam gave that power away, and we'll see that as we work in Genesis. Adam gave that power to the devil, and the devil now has that power. The devil can kill. The devil can cause hurricanes. The devil can cause tornadoes. The devil can cause famine. The devil can cause floods. There are two powers at work in the earth today, one good and one evil. But that was not revealed until the time of Jesus Christ, when the believer was given spirit and power from God to deal with the devil. That's why verse 23, in verse 23 of the same chapter, Jesus Christ turned to his disciples and said privately, blessed are the eyes that see what you see. For I tell you that many prophets and kings wanted to see what you see, but did not see it, and to hear what you hear, and did not hear it. How much longing in Elijah's heart do you think there was to understand why God would be so good and so evil? Or Moses, when great things would happen and then bad things would happen, and Moses would go back to God and he said, God, you haven't delivered your people at all. Just the tremendous, and Jesus Christ said, okay, guys, here it is. There's the devil. There he is. That's what he does. And the disciples said, boy, and the devils are subject unto us through your name. That's brand new. If you look at John chapter 1. John chapter 1. Verse 18. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, or the only begotten Son, is the way the text better reads in the King James, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. Oh, come on. Wait, whoa, 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 what? You mean Moses didn't make known God? Isaiah didn't make known God? Jeremiah didn't make known God? What is it about Jesus Christ that the text can say Jesus Christ made God known? Because what Jesus Christ said, he said, ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to God. Here is my Father. He is love. He is light. He is truth. There is no shadow of turning in him. He blesses. He does good. By the way, all that evil stuff, let me show you his opponent. In this corner is the devil. He is darkness, black, murderer, liar. Look at John chapter 8. In John chapter 8, Jesus Christ, talking to the scribes and Pharisees in verse 42, Jesus said to them, if God were your Father, you would love me, for I came from God, and now I am here. I have not come on my own, but he sent me. Where did it get off? Okay, why is my language not clear to you? Because you are unable to hear what I say. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. See, the devil has his own plans. The devil has his own army. The devil has his own power. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. If because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? He goes on, well, this thing about the devil was totally new. Jesus Christ went around delivering people from devil spirits. Well, before Jesus Christ taught the truth, the people knew about the spirits causing the problem. They knew about the spirits causing the problem, but they thought they were from God. If you'll look at 1 Samuel, I think it's chapter 17. Go to 1 Samuel, I'll get there myself in a second and we'll find this together. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 14. Now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. Does it say an evil spirit from the devil? No. The disciples came to Jesus Christ and said, devils are subject unto us. The text here in Samuel says, oh, it's an evil spirit from God. Again, their understanding was that God was sovereign. God had not revealed to the Old Testament person, because they had not been endued with power from on high, God had not revealed to them the devil. He just said, I'm sovereign, and I cause problems, and I do good. And Deuteronomy says, I set before you this day life and death, blessing and cursing, good and evil, therefore choose life. Verse 15, Saul's attendants said to Saul, hey, look, an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. See, the people saw the spiritual reality, they just misplaced the author. They thought it was God rather than the devil. Understanding that it's the devil that causes these problems, and that in the Old Testament, God hid the devil by the idiom of permission, will allow you to understand why in Exodus God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Why here in Samuel the Lord sends an evil spirit. Where someplace else in Samuel God kills somebody for touching the ark. And event after event. And that's very important. And again, I will refer you to the Introduction to God's Heart class for more information, and the appendix in Is There Death After Life for more information on the idiom of permission. But it is critical to the understanding of the Old Testament. Otherwise, you will not be able to read the Old Testament without becoming convinced that God is indeed a horrible God. Let's go to Genesis chapter 1. In Genesis chapter 1, we're going to start with Genesis chapter 1 and work through this chapter just a little bit. This is certainly a key to understanding the Old Testament, is how God started out with the earth. I'm reading out of the New International Version again. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. The King James reads, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. Number of things we should note here. First of all, as I said in the overview, the Bible begins with God. The Bible doesn't begin with an ethereal, philosophical argument. I have a degree in philosophy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I studied the philosophy of religion. I studied the arguments for the existence of God. None of them held any water or made any sense. The closest I ever came to thinking that somebody had an argument that half proved the existence of God was John Calvin. And I really like what he had to say. You can find it in Calvin's works, and I don't know where. I just had to read them, and it just struck me. But here's what Calvin said. He said he knew that God existed because everybody everywhere hated superiors. Wives hated husbands to boss them around. Workers hated bosses. Slaves hated masters. Privates hated generals. Nobody, no man likes to be told what to do. I mean, you can go to any work crew in the country, stand around, you know, and people gripe about the boss. I mean, it's like a national pastime. Let's gripe about the boss, or the one who has authority over me, or the person up the ladder. And if you're a kid, you hate being told what to do by your parent. No, I'm not doing it. I hear that a lot from my 9-year-old and my 6-year-old. Now, these same people who universally reject being told what to do by other humans that are in a superior position will run over and they'll find a rock, they'll find a stick, they'll find a tea leaf, they'll find an amulet, and they'll say to this rock or this stick or this stone, please tell me what to do. And they'll pour things in a certain way, drop things in a certain way, wave things in a certain way, move things in a certain way, and somehow or other, now, the person isn't going to tell them what to do, but by gum, that rock is going to show them what to do. And Calvin said, this is universal. It doesn't matter what society you're in the world. people go and look for, you know, they hate humans. He said this relates to the fact that humans inherently know that another human is unable to give them guidance, but also inherently know that there is a source of guidance available. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But the Bible starts with God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the word create, and E.W. Bullinger in his Companion Bible has a pretty good appendix that works into this. The word create, it was an old woodworking term, and it was to plane or to polish. When God created, he didn't create this glop and then look at it and say, "Now, why did I make that?" And then take some time and form it into something. When God created the heavens and the earth, it was perfect. There was life on it, not the same life we have today, but there was life on it. And it was during that time period when this first heaven and earth were in existence that if you read Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 about the devil and how the devil would was in the garden of God and whatever, you had a world and you had God ruling over angels. One of those angels was Lucifer, the angel of light. And I will let you read Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, Revelation chapter 12, that talk about the devil and the war in heaven. Because there was a war between God and the devil. And that war destroyed the known order of the world. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it was perfect. The earth then became. Verse 2, the earth was formless and empty. The word was would better be translated became. The earth became formless and empty as a result of this war between God and the devil spirits. And that war destroyed the earth as we know it. Now, for a better work on this translation of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 2. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth became without form and void. I would refer you to two books, both by Arthur C. Custance. The first, an entire book just on Genesis 1, 1 and 1, 2, is called Without Form and Void. Without Form and Void by Arthur C. Custance. Also, he has a couple chapters in a book called Time and Eternity. And Time and Eternity is published by Zondervan. It was part of the Doorway Papers. But Time and Eternity by Arthur C. Custance. And he goes into this gap between Genesis chapter 1-1 and Genesis 1-2. And it's very important to understand that because you have the fossil record. There's the dinosaur bones and all the things that you can look at in paleontological studies that show the gap. Now, another reason why I think that there's a gap there is because there is no indication, to my understanding, that when God created the heavens and the earth, he created the devil just to vex people. If you read Ezekiel and Isaiah and you get a feel for what God initially created and what he wanted, the devil being on earth is a result of the devil's rebellion because of his prideful fall. Well, that rebellion was ancillary or along with a war that's described in Revelation 12. I don't see how in the world the devil could be in the garden of God, then have a war, and a third of the angels be cast down to heaven, and all of a sudden, somewhere in the Garden of Eden, without any kind of introduction, the devil shows up as the devil, where before he was Lucifer, the angel of light. So there's got to be time for the fall of the devil. So in the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth, and they're perfect. Then there is a gap, a war in heaven. The result of that war is that the earth becomes without form and void. And again, you can read those books that have a lot more on the gap in Genesis 1, 1, 1, 2. God now has this earth that because of this war is waste and void. and he wants to get it into habitable condition, so he's going to take the next 6 days and do that. And the first day he'll speak light into being, etc. At this point, I ought to say something about evolution. The evolution, as it is talked about in textbooks and high schools and whatever, just does not really exist. There's nothing about God creating a soup and then over a billion years this soup becoming people. What we know is Lamarckian evolution or Darwinian evolution or Neo-Darwinian evolution or punctuated equilibrium theory. There's nothing to those. They are made up by people that don't want to believe in a God that creates a coherent whole so they can explain what's on the face of the earth. By the way, there is a group. They're in El Cajon, California. They're called the Institute for Creation Research. It was founded by a Dr. Henry Morris. They have some excellent, excellent stuff. Great material and books that show that the fossil record does not prove evolution, that evolution is untenable mathematically, evolution is untenable from a geographical and geophysical standpoint, that it's untenable from the standpoint of hard rock geology, that it's untenable from the standpoint of astronomy, and you can contact the Institute for Creation Research, or their books are in many, many of the Christian bookstores around the country. The major problem that I have with the Institute of Creation Research is that they believe that this whole creation occurred in 6 days rather than recognizing that there was a gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. But the Institute for Creation Research, if you have to deal with evolution, you're a high schooler and you're taking biology, or you're in college and you're taking biology or zoology, or you just want to learn more about evolution, the material is available to show that evolution is untenable. It's not just a matter of, oh, you either believe in evolution or you believe the Bible. Evolution as a scientific theory is untenable, and the work is available to show that. And again, I would contact the Institute for Creation Research. So in verse 3, God creates everything. Everything is destroyed. In verse 3, God said, let there be light. Sometimes you'll hear, oh, on the first day God created, the second day God created, third day God created, fourth day God created. That's not right. When God created, he made something that had never been before. And in the beginning, he created the heavens and the earth because there hadn't been any heavens and earth before. But there had been light before. So God simply said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that the light was good. He separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Now this phrase, there was evening, and there was morning, the first day, is indicative of a period of 24 hours. Sometimes you'll have Christians that will try to meld the Bible and evolution by saying, well, really, evolution could have occurred because these days in Genesis were probably just ages. Well, that's untenable from an internal point of view, because you'd have to have an age of light with nothing else, and then you'd have to have an age of plants when there weren't any sun or moon that the plants could get their heat from. It's really quite untenable. When you look at the phraseology here in the text, there was evening and there was morning the first day. The word day describes the morning and evening, a period of 24 hours. By the way, for you technical buffs, the phrase evening and morning the first day is the figure of speech polar marismos. Polar marismos is where you put the two ends of something to stand for the middle. So if I'm giving an argument and I've laid out the whole argument and then I lean back and I say, well, that's the long and the short of it. That means I've just laid out the entire argument. If you read about the life of Solomon, it'll talk about he will say to God, I don't know how to go out or come in, meaning I don't know how to live my life in front of these people. And so here in Genesis, when it says there was evening and there was morning the first day, that's totally indicative of 24 hours. It is not the use of day as in man's day or the Lord's day, which is an age. Verse 6, God said, let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse sky. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. Oh, by the way, the Hebrew days in the Bible started with the evening. If you remember, the day, the 14th of Nisan, became the 15th of Nisan in the evening. So that's why they start here with evening and morning, because the Hebrew day started with the evening. Verse 9, God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, let dry ground appear, and it was so. And God called the dry ground land, and gathered waters, and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with the seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. Now there's a lot more in this verse that we could go into. Let me tell you just a few things. For example, the Bible just says that these plants produced according to their kinds. We today in America, with all of our little tiny this is that, our scientific discoveries, want to break everything down into families and orders and phyla and genus and species and subspecies and on and on and on. And the Bible just has one word, and it's a kind. And if you're in the same kind, you can reproduce. And if you're not in that same kind, you can't reproduce. It's extremely dangerous to take American binomial nomenclature, the description of the species, phyla, subspecies, whatever, and try to apply that to biblical beasts and animals. That's extremely dangerous, and we've got to be very careful of that. A lot of times an unbeliever might say, oh, well, see, the Bible's not right because it says things can't reproduce after their own kind, but we've taken this and this, and they reproduce. Well, who's to say what that biblical kind was? There isn't anything in the Bible that describes those kinds. Verse 12, the land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed. Now, the word bearing in the Hebrew is the word seeding. So you've got plants that seed seed, and trees bearing fruit with the seed in it. Now, there are two main types of plants. There are plants that seed seed, and there are plants that have fruit that have the seed inside. So you have a dandelion or a ragweed or a milkweed or whatever, a grass that produces the seed, and then that seed blows away. The seed is outside, on the outside, and it blows away or floats away or flies away or whatever, and those plants seed seed. Then there are other plants that the seed is in something, like a carrot, like an apple, like a tomato, and those plants have seed in themselves. So it's important to understand there's a lot more in Genesis about biology, zoology, botany, than a lot of people are willing to admit. And these are the two basic kinds of seeds, and it's well worth the study. Two basic kinds of plants. And this is well worth studying if that is an area of interest to you. Verse 14, God said, let there be lights on the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days of years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the sky, the day, the lesser light to govern the night. Of course, the greater light is the sun, the lesser light is the moon. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. Now back to verse 14. These lights that serve as signs to mark seasons and days of year, and to give light on the earth. If you would like at this point, you can turn off the tape and read Psalm 19. Because the stars gave more than physical light to the earth. The stars gave spiritual light to the earth. Much of that spiritual light that the stars gave in astronomy, as it would have originally been known, has been perverted into what we now call astrology. Learn about yourself from the stars. Astronomy, the true science, is the study of the stars, and if you wanted to take that into a biblical perspective, by the way, E.W. Bullinger did a fine work, has a book called The Witness of the Stars. The truth of the stars is that they proclaim Jesus Christ. The stars proclaim the story of Jesus Christ. Now, astrology wants to pervert that truth so that the stars will tell something about you. You give me your birth date and where you were born and I will tell you about you. The truth in the stars is that they proclaim Jesus Christ. And a great piece of work on that is E.W. Bullinger's The Witness of the Stars. And again, you can see in Psalm 19 where it says, night unto night they utter knowledge. You know, you get a guy who walks out and he looks up at a bunch of stars. Well, they're sure neat. What knowledge do they utter? They utter a lot of knowledge if you understand the formations of the stars and the names of the stars and then can relate that to biblical history. By the way, one thing that you should see here, the moon now is not part of the original creation of Genesis 1:1. The moon was created just somewhere around 4000 BC, right before the creation of Adam. The moon was made just before the creation of Adam. Now that's intriguing and is related to science. In fact, there's a man, and I forget his name, that has a book called The Moon, which talks about the moon in the Bible and some of the geophysical characteristics of the moon. But it's intriguing that when we put a man on the moon, NASA and scientists and all had done studies that the moon was so many billion years old and the space dust should have been so many feet thick. And there was initially some concern that anything we sent to the moon would just be swallowed up in space muck, just settle into the space dust and be gone. Well, we get up to the moon and you land, and everybody, I think, has seen the pictures of the men's footsteps on the moon and how thick the dust is. And lo and behold, if that isn't just about the thickness that you'd expect, if the moon was 6,000 years old, which, of course, fits beautifully with what we see here in Genesis, that the moon would have been about 6,000 years old. In verse 20, after the fourth day, God said, let the water teem with living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. Intriguing use of the word create here. In the beginning, in Genesis 1:1, God created the heavens and the earth. But he didn't create light in Genesis 1:3. He didn't create the dry land. He didn't create the waters. He didn't create seed-bearing plants. He didn't create the fruit tree within itself. He didn't create the vegetation. But now, when it comes to the living creatures in the sea, God creates. What's being brought into existence that hadn't been brought into existence before? The soul life. And it uses the word nephesh, soul, in the text. In fact, if you look at verse 20 again, the word creatures in your New International Version, God said, let the water teem with living creatures. That's the word soul. Nephesh in the Hebrew, soul. I was flying up to Indianapolis to tape this class that I'm taping now and sat next to an agnostic, and he thumped on the little platform, what do you call that, little tray that the plane has, and says, animals don't have a soul. I begged to differ. The Bible says that animals do have a soul, and here it is, verse 20. God says, let the waters teem with living souls. And let birds fly above the earth, across the expanse of the sky, So God created the great souls of the sea, every living and moving thing with which the water teems. That soul life in animals had never been in existence in the previous earth. So whatever life form was empowering the dinosaurs and whatever is in the fossil record was not the soul life that we have in our lives today. God tells these, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the waters of the sea. There was evening and morning, the fifth day. Verse 24, God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. By the way, domestic animals are an important part of our life cycle, as you know. I mean, you need to have dogs and cows and sheep and pigs. It's intriguing that people cannot seem to domesticate non-domesticated animals. You can't seem to domesticate a lion, for example. The Bible makes a difference. The Bible makes a difference between domestic animals and non-domestic animals, which makes perfect sense if what we understand about creation, God created man, he wanted to bless man, so he makes specific animal kinds that will help and bless man, cows and goats and dogs and whatever. So God made the wild animals also according to their kind, the livestock according to their kind, all the souls that move along the ground according to their kind, and God saw it was good. So God is creating the animals, and now we will pick up with the next tape with God making man in his own image, and we'll follow through with man in the Garden of Eden.